Sarnai. Welcome to all our listeners who are joining us from all around the world and looking forward to another dissemination of the Lord Buddha's Dhamma. We gather every weekend to share our knowledge and our wisdom of what we understand as the Lord Buddha's teaching, a teaching that helps us to eradicate the fires that burn within us, to quench those fires, to put out those fires, and in putting out those fires find a happiness and a bliss and fulfillment and satisfaction that we never seem to have been able to get hold of, put our hands to, and put our minds to. A happiness that we've always been looking elsewhere, we've always been seeking in other places, and always been wondering why we keep pursuing happiness but never seem to have been able to achieve it. So when we come across this teaching, when we come across the true nature of the universe, the true nature of how we operate as human beings, our minds operate as sentient beings, then we begin to think, we begin to analyze, we begin to reflect, and we begin to understand about ourselves. In fact, Buddhist philosophy and the Lord Buddha's doctrine is really a teaching which helps us understand ourselves more than anything else. So, as we again come together to make use of this opportunity to do just that, let us first reflect on the fact that it is because of His infinite compassion that we have the teaching today to discuss and to understand and to help us walk a path to liberation. Let us pay our respects to the unequal one, the unparalleled one, the unvanquished one, the perfect one, the Supreme Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Let us also take a moment to invite all the devas, brahmas, spirits and demons and the dead, anyone that we may have come past in samsara, anyone who might have been of assistance to us, who might have helped us get where we are today, let us accept the reality that the reason we are human beings today is preconditioned, and there will have been an infinite number of conditions that would have had to fall into place for that result to have materialized, and invariably there will have been countless beings, people and devas and brahmas, and those beings who might even be spirits and demons, and also perhaps in the hells today, who might have helped us get to where we are today. So as we gather to listen to the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, to reflect on His teaching and to liberate ourselves from the shackles of samsara, let us extend an invitation out to all those beings who may be fortunate enough to join us, who may rejoice in witnessing meritorious deeds such as this. May they be able to listen to the Dhamma, may they be able to rejoice in the Dhamma, may they be able to rejoice in the merits accrued in the delivery of this sermon and also in listening to this sermon. May their celestial powers grow, and ultimately may they all understand the Four Noble Truths which would help them escape the endless rebirth cycle that is samsara. So, as I extend this invitation, in your minds and hearts, think of all those people who you may have come across in this birth, as well as any beings you may have come across in the past, and also any devas and any brahmas who may be able to accept your invitation and join us and listen to this sermon. Samanta chak Gattavalesu Atta Gacchantu Devata Sattamam Munirajasansa Sunantu Sakamukkadam Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayang Badanta Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayang Badanta Dhamma Savana Kalo Ayang Badanta. Let us also take a moment to reflect on the fact that in our time in samsara, from time immemorial, from the time we started our journey in samsara, we have not always been kind and generous. We have not always been helpful and pleasant to others. Oftentimes and almost virtually all the time, because of our association with immoral people and not having been able to recognize with Aryas or noble people, we will have often insulted them, criticized them, hurt them, caused them harm. And in having done so, committed Aryopavadas or insulting and slandering these noble people. That could have been Samma Sambuddhas, the Supreme Buddhas. It could have been Paccheka Buddhas. It could have been an Arahant or Arahants. It could have been any other type of Aryas or any other noble people. Having done so, the karmic energy that we would have released into the universe now prevents our path to Nibbana. As we gather now and try to listen to the Dhamma and understand the Dhamma, it acts as a barrier to our progress and our enlightenment. So, before we commence this sermon, let us all seek forgiveness from all those noble Aryas. Let us be remorseful and accept the true fact that when we acted in that way, it was because of our ignorance, it was because of our delusion. But today, we listen to the Dhamma, we practice the Dhamma, and we are ever so grateful that all those Aryas are the reason that we have this Dhamma today and a path to liberation. So in your hearts, seek their forgiveness. May all those Aryas that we may have insulted forgive us. And may we be able to understand and listen to this Dhamma with our open hearts and open minds, and may we be able to realize the supreme bliss of Nibbana during the course of this Dhamma sermon itself. Okay. I recently met with some people who visited us from another country. And they said they were going to be bringing some friends along as well to one of our sermons, and I think that will be possibly next week. So as I always do, this is a reminder that the opportunity is always there for you all, for wherever you're listening to this from. If you're ever in the proximity, if you're ever around or in Sri Lanka, perhaps just even on a holiday, you're more than welcome to join us. Just do please let us know that you will be joining so we can make sure we have we can make necessary arrangements to accommodate you. And as I always say, there's always a certain advantage to being in the presence of whoever is preaching the Dhamma in both ways, because it helps, in my case, me to experience what it is that you understand when you're listening to this sermon, and also what it is that you might be struggling to understand, and therefore it helps me use various examples and analogies and try and help clarify those points further. But also, if you're a listener, then it's always helpful to be in the presence, because that association helps in various ways to help understand the Dhamma. And I mean, it's only common knowledge that, for instance, body language is a very powerful tool for communication. But I'm not necessarily talking about those tools and techniques. I'm talking about in the practice of listening to the Buddha Dhamma, it helps to be in the presence of the person that is preaching it, because it helps you understand the Dhamma better. So, and I have also said, particularly for our listeners, perhaps our young listeners who might struggle sometimes with their short attention spans, if you're sat in front of a computer, which is probably what you're doing right now, with your headphones on and perhaps maybe playing a game on the computer, or perhaps watching another YouTube video, but listen to this sermon. I've got nothing against you. I'm just saying, to understand this Dhamma, you need that complete and total concentration. And that concentration is something that comes from practicing some kind of continence and self-control. And that self-control needs to come from within, because you need to realize, you need to understand why is it that you're listening to this Dhamma in the first place. And when you do, and you understand that this is the reason I'm doing this, is so that I can find a solution to the greatest problem I've ever suffered in samsara from, then that self-control, that discipline comes from within. But until such time comes, until you're able to do that, as I've advised or suggested in the past, if possible, join up with some friends on a Sunday afternoon or whenever it is you're listening to this, and get together with, and then by friends I mean friends who are interested in this Dhamma, not necessarily just the guy from across the road who you meet up to go out and play in the park, or you know, go out for a drink. I'm not talking about that kind of friend. I'm talking about Kalyana Mitras. Get together with them and find the opportunity to listen together, because then even when you feel like you're beginning to sidetrack, the presence of somebody else will kind of police you into focusing your attention on the sermon, and that will help you with your understanding. So, if you're looking forward to join us, then I think next week we'll attempt to deliver the sermon from the premises of the monastery, if we have the technology to help us support that. So please do join us, and we can make the facilities available to you. I would also like to take a short moment to thank some of our listeners who contacted us and expressed their interest with transliterating these sermons, as in typing them out into readable documents. And as I've stated before, that can be extremely worthwhile, not just for the person that is going to be reading them, but also for the person that's typing them out, because you're paying complete attention as you listen to the sermon, and then typing it out means you're with complete consciousness, with complete concentration, you're focusing on that sermon. And therefore sometimes you might come across areas which you think to yourself, actually that bit, yes, I listened to it, but now I realize I didn't quite understand it. Or because you're listening to it over and over again, perhaps sometimes because you can't, because you need to do that to type it out, then repeated listening to the sermon helps you with your understanding as well. So regardless of whether someone is going to be reading it one day or not, whoever is going to be doing it, and again, as I say, thank you to those who volunteered to do that, the benefits and advantages of you doing that to yourself is unquantifiable. I can't say it's so much, it is that much. And the merits that you will acquire in doing so is also huge. And those merits will absolutely and most certainly help you in your understanding of the Dhamma and in your practice of the path as well. But once again, on behalf of everyone really, and those who will be reading them in the future, a huge thank you to those who volunteered. And the opportunity still exists because we have a number of sermons already on YouTube, I think about almost 20 in number now. We have been able to locate a few that were done before we started transmitting, broadcasting these sermons online, and in due course we'll make them available. But if there are others who are wishing to take part, then as usual, please do let us know, and that can also be made available. One of our listeners recently asked me a good question, and it was more of a request than I think a question, but this request came through multiple channels, and particularly our recent visitors from abroad, because they had not listened to the Dhamma before, certainly not the Dhamma that we talk about or talk of, wanted a explanation of the Lord Buddha's teaching in simple terms. What does it mean? Why should I listen to the Buddha Dhamma? What is there for me and for someone who is a novice to this teaching? How do I find value in this? Where do I start? Where do I go from there? And how do I know I'm on the right path? What is the ultimate goal here? And I think, you know, that's a very good question. It's a very interesting topic, because we all started somewhere. When we were born, we didn't have an understanding of the Lord Buddha's teaching. All of us would have been on a quest for some time, looking for the teaching. Some perhaps were just given the teaching, and before you knew it, it was right in front of you, in your face, and you listened to it and thought, good heavens, you know, that's profound, that's meaningful. Yes, this makes sense to me, and now I'm going to practice the path. Whereas there have been others who would have dedicated many years of their lives looking for the true teaching, the true philosophy, and would have practiced various forms of meditation, gone to various classes and various teachers. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. And in fact, we would encourage people to do that. Because until you find something that makes sense to you, that is meaningful to you, then obviously you have to keep looking for this. Why do I say this? Because that is what my teacher taught me. Who's my teacher? The Lord Buddha. That is what Prince Siddhartha did. When he renunciated from the palace, he went looking and he went and learned from all the teachers that were sharing their philosophy in his time. Various teachers taught various different practices of meditation, practices of virtue, practices of developing various powers, supernormal powers, and having gone to all of those teachers, having practiced all of those disciplines and all of those philosophies, and having come to perfect them in every different way. And in fact, in wherever he went, he had perfected the art, he had perfected the science, he had perfected the teaching, and he would usually be the best in the teacher's class. And actually what Prince Siddhartha found was all of his teachers asked him to take over his students. At which point Prince Siddhartha would say, actually no, or the ascetic Siddhartha at that time, he wasn't a prince after he obviously renunciated, would say, no, this is not what I came here for. I didn't come here to be a master. I came here to be a student. I came here to learn. I came here to find my liberation. And unfortunately, Master, thank you for your time, but I have come to realize that what I'm looking for does not exist here. And this is what all of you should be doing. We should all be looking until we realize, yes, I found it. And then, because otherwise, where's the motive to continue on that path? Where's the motive to complete that journey? Fortunately, we don't have to go looking for lots of different ways. Having practiced this Dhamma for a certain period of time and having listened to these sermons, and we do get emails from time to time. Just the other early this week, we had an email come through from a gentleman in India, in Bangalore, and he's looking forward to come and spend some time with us in the next month or so, because he's been listening to these sermons and he feels that he has come a long way from where he started as someone who knew nothing of Buddhism, to where he is now, and he feels that he has a really good understanding of Anicca Dukkha Anatta and is able to apply that. And he's expressed in his email how things that used to disappoint him and upset him and set off those fires of desire, anger and delusion no longer upset him, no longer agitate him, no longer vex him as they used to. And so he finds that in his heart he's calmer and cooler than he used to be. So he wants to come and spend some time with us. And by all means, that's great. So likewise, we should all keep looking until we find something that makes sense to us. But there's something that I would advise against, which is once you've found something that makes sense, once you've found something meaningful, once you've found something that makes, when you apply your intellect, it makes sense to you, then at least try it out for a certain time at least. Walk the walk. Walk the path until, before you decide, hey, you know, let me go looking even more. Because otherwise what you'll do is you'll always be looking. You will never be able to satisfy yourself with something. And sometimes you might actually come across, who knows, you know, let's say back in the day of when the Lord Buddha was around, people would have done the same. People were inquisitive. They were walking around looking for various teachers. How many people do you think would have come across the Buddha and would have listened to him, to one of his sermons, and perhaps the Buddha might have given a sermon, but having realized that this person who is in front of me does not have the capability to understand the Dhamma, he might have focused his teaching on someone else, perhaps a deva who this poor man who's sitting in front is not able to see, but the Buddha gives a sermon and is focusing it on the deva who's able to achieve the noble attainments. But this man listening, after having listened, says, yeah, okay, right, I'll see you later, thank you very much for that, and walked away. That would have happened, and I'm sure it would have happened. In fact, the Buddha tells us that when on his way to meet up with the five ascetics, he finds, he comes across this person, I think he was a Brahmin at the time, and he sees the Buddha coming from a distance, and he approaches him and says, who are you? And he says, I am the glorious winner. Are you a winner? And then the Buddha says, I am the supreme, I am the perfect one. And then by winner he means obviously he's won this battle of defeating Mara. And then this Brahmin says, oh well, all the best to you and good luck to you, sir, and he walks away. If it hadn't been the case, and if he had actually taken some time to practice the path, listen to him and spend more time with the Buddha and his teaching, today we wouldn't necessarily be talking about the five ascetics as much as we do, because his first disciple would have been that person. But hey, such is the way life works. But this is why I would encourage you, once you've found something that makes sense, before you let go of that and keep looking, then take some time to explore that further and then see how much that makes sense to you before you move on again, because otherwise you'll always be moving on. And even the day before your death, you'll still be moving on, not knowing that time's up and you've not made your choice. That would be a shame, a real shame. So, how do you then, so on your quest for the teaching, how do you actually know when you found the right thing? Would be a good question to ask. And it's a question everyone should be asking. How do I know when I found the Buddha's teaching? How do I know when I found the teaching that, well, forget the Buddha's teaching, right? when the Bodhisattva was looking for something, he wasn't looking for the Buddha's teaching, because obviously he was a Bodhisattva. Obviously he's not going to be able to get it from the Buddha. He would have to find it out for himself, right? So this is why when the Bodhisattva went looking for the truth, and you know, in the text it says King Satchagavesi, King Kusalagavesi. Satchagavesi is he went in search for the truth, Satcha being the truth. And Kusalagavesi, he went in search for a Dhamma that would help him eradicate these fires. Kusala, we've talked about Kusala in the past, the etymology of that word, and Kusala being, or Akusal being the defilers, and Kusala being, Ku being bad, and Sala being to remove or to eradicate. So eradicating that which is bad is Kusala, or wholesome, as we usually use that word in English. So he went looking for the truth, he went looking for what was wholesome. He didn't go looking for the Buddha to teach him that. If he had done that, he wouldn't have found it, because he was a Bodhisattva. He was the one who was going to become a Buddha, obviously, right? And this is what we should all be doing. We should always be looking for the truth. We should always be looking for that which helps us find what is wholesome. And by that, I think I would say the simplest explanation I can give is, look for something that helps you achieve whatever it is that you're looking for in life. And unsurprisingly, what you will find is that we're all looking for essentially the same things in life. It might feel that, no, that can't be the case, because you open your eyes and you look around, you know, you see people doing all sorts of professions. You'll see people of all sorts of ages, and you might wonder, well, how come? How are you able to say that a young person or a baby is looking for the same thing as a young person, who is looking for the same thing as a middle-aged man, and is looking for the same thing as an elderly person? How can you say that a man's looking for the same things as a woman is? How can you say that a young teenager is looking for the same things as a mature elderly gentleman who is, you know, at the pinnacle of his profession? Are they really the same things? Well, I would argue yes, they are. Because if you look at fundamentally what we are all looking for, it can generally be distilled down to happiness. Happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment in life. This is what we are all looking for. Why does a baby cry? Because it's looking for happiness. It's looking to relieve itself from some kind of discomfort it's in. That could be because it's wetted itself. It could be because it's hungry. It could be because there's a mosquito that's biting it, and it wants to make the world know, I am in discomfort. Come and sort me out. That's what the baby is doing when it's crying. And then once you go past that age and you're a young boy, or a young girl, a young person, what do you do then? A child, right? What does a child do? Well, the child obviously would start to school at some point, and again when it's hungry would go and ask for food from his parents, or, you know, play with toys, go see friends, watch a movie, whatever. Why does a child do these things? It's to be happy. Whatever makes him or her uncomfortable, whatever comes in the form of discomfort, he or she will do whatever is required to relieve him or herself from that position. Now, again, if you think about why is it that parents encourage children to go to school, it's because parents understand that to live a satisfied life, satisfied within inverted commas, when you are older, you need a certain background, and that background comes in the form of education, so you can earn a living. And that can only be done if you have a certain education. Oh, well, usually can only be done when you have a certain level of education. And for that reason, children go to school. But likewise, for similar reasons, But again, going down back to happiness, a child might say, I don't want to go to school. And then it protests, I don't want to go to school. Why does it say that? Because it wants to be happy. Because school for that child might, on that particular day, not be something that is fun. Right? The reason I'm kind of breaking it down to this, make it really simple and relatable to us young listeners, and is because, you know, I'm quite deliberately trying to break it down to this level so everyone can understand this. And then of course middle age, you go to university. Why do you go to university? So you can study further, you can get yourself a degree. Again, why? To be happy. Sometimes you even do things which in the immediate term are not pleasurable. I can't think of the last time I sat an exam thinking, yay, I'm going to do this exam. I'm overjoyed, I can't wait to do this exam. I can't remember the last time I did that. And I think all of you would be the same, or most of you at least, unless there are the really studious people among you. But I wasn't one of them. And there will be times when you have to go for an interview, which can bring butterflies into your stomach. Okay? Or sometimes when you have to deliver a speech in front of a large audience. Again, all of these things sometimes can be discomforting, it can be unpleasant, it can be really difficult, but the reason you do this, I mean, think of a marathon runner. Why does he run a marathon? Running the marathon is not fun. He runs the marathon, he or she runs the marathon so that, because there's an end result to be gained from that. There's a goal, there's a target to be gained from that, and with that in mind, they would do this. Okay, so with as we're looking at this, you know, people at various points in life, various stages of life, do all these sorts of things so they can seek happiness in life. And then the reason that we work ultimately when you grow up and get yourself a job is so you can earn money. You earn money so you can put food on your plate. And again, comes down to the basic necessities: feed your hunger, put a shelter over your head, put some clothes around your body, and get yourself some medicine when you're not feeling well, to treat yourself. The basic necessities. And why do we work hard for these basic necessities? Because when you don't have them, you can be in great discomfort, and therefore we work hard for that. And then also, why do we make friends? Because we want to be happy. We would like to talk to somebody when we have a friend. Sometimes when we have a problem, we like to ring someone up. And have you never been in this position where all the other person on the line is doing is saying, okay, yeah, all right, okay. They've not said anything else. And the entire conversation is just like that. I've done this plenty of times for my friends when I was at school. They'd ring me up and say, hey, I've got this really serious problem. I want you to give me some advice. I say, okay, tell me what's your problem. And then he and I are on the phone for about an hour. All I've said is, okay, yeah, well, tell me more about it. Yeah, well, sure, okay, so what happened? I've just asked him some questions. I haven't said a word. I've not given him a word of advice. But at the end of the telephone conversation, he goes, you know, that was great talking with you. Thank you so much for giving me that advice. You know, now I understand what it is I need to do, and I feel so relieved. Thank you so much. What a great friend you are. I said, well, you know, that's I'm just a natural. So again, why do people do that? It's because they want to relieve themselves from a certain mental or physical state of discomfort so they can be happy. And something I often say when I go to sermons is that time when I went to my parents and asked them, can I ordain? And one of the questions was, why are you in such a rush? Okay? Which I think is a question that all young people, when they go to ordain, is something that they get asked from their parents and other relations, unless you're really fortunate where actually your parents are the ones who are forcing you to ordain. And I'll withdraw the word forcing. I'd use the word encourage you to ordain, and then you ask the question, why so soon, instead. So it can be both ways. In my case, it was I asked for it, and my parents asked me, why so soon? And then, like today, I remember I asked them, you know, you're in your late 50s and late 60s, and the tell me what is it that you wanted in life, and they tell me with no room for doubt, yes, it was happiness that they were looking for. This is why they worked hard, they studied hard, they got married, they had kids, okay, they went abroad and they did all these things to be happy. And then I asked them the question, well, so you're in your late 50s, your late 60s, but still I see you when you have a problem, you know, you get into arguments with other people, between yourselves, and when you're looking for, when you have other problems, you know, financial problems might be health problems, might be social problems, you know, you're still battling, I still find yourselves with your heads in your hands, you know, having sleepless nights. How many sleepless nights did my mother and father have when I said I was going to go Dane? So, you've lived all this time looking for happiness, and yet today there are things around you that make you unhappy. There are things that happen in your life that make you unhappy. So clearly, that path that they've walked on, that path that they've gone on, looking for happiness, did not give them a permanent solution to the problem that they were looking for. It was just plastering all the time. But when the plaster fades, you have to go and put it up again. It's like putting wallpaper. You know, that fades and you have to go put wallpaper again. Or when you have to paint your houses, it's the same thing, right? So, and so this is what I'm saying. Everyone does whatever they, you know, things they say, things they do, things they think is to be happy. Even something as simple as, and yes, I continue to keep these examples, so it really sinks in within you. Why do people do these things? It's to be happy, right? Think of a guy who's just been given a boot by a girl. Okay, what does he do? He gets into bed and he starts sulking. Okay, he listens to boot songs. I don't know if you have them in other countries, but in Sri Lanka we have lots of them. Boot songs. We call them boot songs because when you get booted by a girl or a guy, these are songs that are written by they're produced by these singers, and they talk about similar experiences. Not necessarily ones that they've experienced, but, you know, that's obviously art. So they create these works of art so that someone can listen to it, and in listening to it, you know, they sulk in their own hearts, and they feel like there's someone else that they can share that experience with. So why does a guy do that? It's to help them feel better. Why do you go to the doctor? It's to help you feel better. Why do you go to the lawyer, to your solicitor? It's to help you feel better. It's to be happy. Okay? So, hopefully, now it's without a shadow of a doubt. Why do we do everything from lifting a finger up in the morning to opening my eyes in the morning to closing my eyes when I go to bed at night? Everything we do to be happy. At least to try and be happy. So, if we are in this position where we dedicate our lives to trying to be happy, remember it's trying to be happy, then we've got to understand, we've got to accept that we are not happy right now. This is why you're always trying to be happy. It's like a man who's trying to be rich. If a man was rich, he wouldn't try to be rich, he's just rich. You don't hear Bill Gates saying, I'm working hard so I can be rich one day. You don't hear him say that. Or you don't hear Warren Buffett saying, I'm working hard so I can be rich one day. He doesn't say that. But you hear, you know, the normal guy on the street, you know, the guy who's prepared his interview papers and is going to the interview, you know, with his head held up high, with his, you know, shoes polished and smart shirt on, say, I'm going to get this job so I can be rich one day. He wants to be rich because he's not rich right now. He wants to be healthier. You know, people someone who's healthy. You know, right now you and I, we wouldn't be saying, I want to be healthy, because we feel we are normally of good health. But if you go to the hospital, then everyone there will be patients and they'll all be saying, we want to be healthier, right? We want to do something so we get better. This is why we do certain things. So, the reason that we are trying to be happy then is because we are not happy right now. That's what we've got to understand this. Because, remember I've said in the past, I give you a sheet of paper, there are random numbers written on it, and I ask you, is there a particular number that stands out, stands particularly interesting? You say no. I give you a second sheet of paper. On there is a formula, a mathematical formula. Now I give you back this first sheet of paper, and one number stands out and looks particularly interesting. Why? Because it's the answer to the question that was written in the second sheet of paper. So, when you realize what the problem is, the answer becomes obvious. Otherwise, you slap someone in the face with the answer, they're not going to accept it. It's not going to be half as interesting. Okay? So this is why we're trying to understand exactly what the problem is. So we're not happy right now. This is why we're always looking for happiness. We're waiting for happiness to come to us tomorrow. Why do I go to work today? So I can be happy tomorrow. Why do I go to school today? So I can be happy tomorrow. Why do I wake up this morning? So I can be happy today, later on today. Why do I go to sleep today? So I can be happy when I wake up. Right? So, every time we dedicate our lives, every moment, to try and be happy in the next moment. Tomorrow, next year, in the next 10 years. Okay? So then the problem is that we are not happy right now. Let's accept that. What Buddhism teaches us, and what, well, practically all religions give us, is the path to happiness. There are religions that teach us that to be happy, one must go to heaven. There are religions that say to be happy, you have to reunite with the Mahabrahma. Okay, when you do such and such things, you accumulate merits. Lots of religions talk about merit. Or you fall into the good books. Let's put it that way. Okay, I've read certain texts that say actually there's literally a big book where on it is written all the things you've done. And certainly this is how my parents used to teach me when I was a really young boy. When you die, you're going to go to this place, you're going to go to heaven, and they're going to have a book on which is going to be written all the things you've said and you've done, and how you hurt your dad's feelings, and how you were really naughty when you went out and misbehaved yourself, and you were mischievous. That's how that's how they disciplined me. Okay, in this big book. And then they're either going to let you through the gates of heaven or shun you from those gates and say, no, you're not allowed to enter. So I was dreadful of that day. I was mortified that day would come one day. But now I don't feel that bad. I feel that I'm okay for now. So all religions give or teach a way to be happy, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Hinduism. And the Lord Buddha's teaching, I prefer not to call it Buddhism, because Buddhism is a religion, but what we talk about is Buddhist philosophy. What did the Buddha teach us? It's not necessarily a religion. And half the time I spend in sermons is actually to try and explain the difference between a religion, which is an establishment for society to accept that there's a construct there's a certain standing, and there's a certain entity called this religion. But the Buddha's teaching is just the truth. It's just the way the nature operates. It's just how things happen in the world. You don't need a religion for that. Okay? So they teach us a way to be happy. And in fact, you've got to think, why do people actually look for a religion? If there's science that helps us turn on a light, heat the water in a kettle, cook our food, watch television, okay, go places. If there's science that helps us make life easy or easier, then why do people actually look for religion? It's worth considering. Because, you see, people are always, as I said, looking for things that make them happy. When you've gone to one restaurant and a second restaurant opens up in town, you want to go and try that out as well. Because the reason you're doing that is because actually the first restaurant didn't make you happy in the first place. This is why it didn't make you as happy as you could be. This is why you go looking for the second restaurant. This is why you patronize the second restaurant. And when you watch TV, why you change TV channels? It's because you're watching one TV channel, you're watching that program, and when you realize that's not making me as happy as I could be right now, it's not making me as happy as I thought I was going to be right now watching this, then you flick your TV channel and you're watching something else right now. Okay? So likewise, when human beings they begin to live their lives. I mean, there are some people who are encouraged to pick up a religion because their parents were religious. If you come from a Christian family, then you will most likely be Catholic or Christian, and you will follow that teaching. You will explore that teaching. If you come from a Muslim family, then you will study Islam and you will look to find happiness from that. If you come from a Buddhist family, then you will look to find happiness again from Buddhist teaching. There is that. But there are also secular people. So secular people are people who don't accept any religion. And some also believe in atheism. There are no gods, so they don't look for any supernatural or external factor, external source of happiness. They just live life and take life by the horns, so to speak. And they just say, well, if there's science that helps me solve my day-to-day problems, so that should make me happy. But even they are looking for happiness. And if they are also looking for happiness, then that tells us that they're not happy right now. If anyone's looking for happiness, they're looking for happiness because they're not happy right now. That's what we've got to understand. So, when we come across the Buddhist teaching, we've then got to ask ourselves the question, well, what does the Buddhist teaching offer, what does Buddhist philosophy offer that is not offered in other religions and that is not offered in science? Because you have these alternatives. You could pick any one of them. There's, you know, that's what freedom of choice is all about. Freedom to follow any religion, any religious philosophy that you like. That choice is important and that choice is available to all. So why look at Buddhist teaching? It's because, again, what I have found in my study of Buddhist philosophy is that it really makes the problem crystal clear. And until I came across Buddhist philosophy in the way that I practice it now, what I realized was I was always trying to solve the wrong problem. Yes, I was trying to be happy, but I was applying the wrong formula to get this answer called happiness. In my formula, I've got happiness as the result of a certain function, and I've got a number of variables that I have to keep changing to get to that answer, because I know what the answer is, happiness, but I keep changing these variables. What I realized was in life, when I tried out various different variables and plugging them into my equation, the happiness that came out, or the answer that came out of that equation, always looked like happiness. It was almost happiness, but it was never true happiness. It was never this supreme bliss of Nibbana that we wish each other. And what we expect out of the Buddhist teaching and practicing that Buddhist teaching. It was almost like the real thing, but it was never the real thing. This is why I always kept looking, and this is why you should also keep looking until, as I said, you know, the Bodhisattva did this himself, King Satchagavesi, King Kusalagavesi. What is it? What is the truth? But don't fall for something that looks like the truth. Take the truth. Until you find the truth, keep looking. But once you've found the truth, then you should be satisfied that my search is complete and now I should practice what I've found. It's like if a man kept looking for a wife every day, he would never get married and settle down. You go looking, you look, you know, you visit a few young women, young ladies, and once you found someone you're happy with, then you settle down. Right? So, by the way, this is not me encouraging you to do that. I'm practicing a different path in life, and this is the path I would encourage everyone and all to do. But that's for you to decide. But I was just using an example there, or an analogy there. So again, in my case, I was plugging in different variables, trying to get this happiness that what I was looking for in life, and this is what we are all looking for in life. And what I found was Buddhist philosophy, or the Lord Buddha's teaching, gave me the doctrine that I, or he gave me, or the Buddha's teaching gave me certain values that I could plug into my equation, and like hitting the jackpot with a casino machine, it's like, voila, there you go, you won the jackpot. It was just like that. I remember that day when I was listening to this teaching for the first time, and those variables I had opened up, and I was waiting for, well, you know, I'm always looking for happiness every passing moment, every waking moment, as we said, from the time you wake your eyes up in the morning to the time you close your eyes, you're looking for this thing called happiness. And when these answers came through, I plugged them into my equation, and out came the result, happiness, jackpot, I had it. So this is what Buddhist teaching offers. And the way that the Buddhist teaching offers this is by helping us to understand really what is the problem in the first place. The reason that we fall for, and I use the word deliberately, fall for science, and perhaps follow the some other teachings that help, that promise us of happiness in the heavens, is because in all of these teachings and all of these doctrines, the fundamental premise is that to be happy, you've got to exist. You've got to, you know, being happy is someone that is alive and someone that is living, someone that is creating something, someone that is producing something, someone that is generating something, and someone that is rejoicing in something. So, according to those teachings, to be happy, I've got to be producing something, I've got to be creating something, I've got to be making something. Now, that is okay to a certain extent until you begin to wonder, well, if I'm creating something, if I've got to be producing something, if I've got to be making something, then what happens when I am unable to make those things? What happens when I'm unable to produce those things? And what about all of the factors that I need to plug in to create those things? What if I can't find those things that, you know, the raw materials that help me make that? Then what happens? And also, when we begin to understand that everything in this world is transient, so nothing survives the ultimate test of time, everything perishes at some point, then if I'm creating something that helps me be happy, then what happens to those things that I have to create? They're going to destroy one day, they're going to perish one day, and then that's going to have an impact on my efforts to be happy. So if that happens to be the case, then you really have to think again. So this is why in the Buddha's teaching, the fundamental principle or the fundamental premise, the fundamental philosophy of being happy and the supreme bliss of Nibbana is actually where there is no existence. There is no birth. There is no being that is alive to be happy in the sensual sense of being happy. Because happiness is defined in other religions and other teachings by defining this sentient being. It could be a human being, it could be a god, it could be an angel that is happy by enjoying sensual pleasures or by being in the presence of someone else. When the Lord Buddha comes into this world, he teaches us about cause and effect. And he teaches us that everything is conditioned, preconditioned. For as long as the conditions exist, and for as long as the conditions are fulfilled, you get a particular result. And if you're attached to that result, then when the conditions change, well, you're going to suffer. Because you attach to yourself. And attachment is the process of setting expectations. What happens when expectations are not met? You're disappointed. So if by looking for happiness what we are doing is setting expectations on either material things that we think bring us happiness, and this is what science talks about, to be happy, grab hold of material things that can bring you happiness, a nice new brand new TV, 60-inch, 70-inch television, flat screen, surround sound, 3D vision. You know, this is what science gives us. Every day it gives us some new gadget, some new fancy item that says, well, this is better than the last one. What science is really saying is, this is going to make you happier than the last one did. Yet we forget that, well, the reason I'm still looking for something else to make me happy is because I'm still sad. I'm still unhappy, I'm still disappointed, I'm still unsatisfied with my life, I'm still unfulfilled. So every day we're looking for something new. Every day we're looking for a new gadget, a new item, a new toy, a new trick to make us happy. Okay? So this is where science and the Buddhist teaching go in different ways. Because Buddhist teaching is about understand that all things in this universe are conditioned, including your happiness is also conditioned. If your happiness is a condition of how many material possessions you have with you, how many people that you like you get to associate, how many people that you dislike you don't get to associate, if your happiness is a condition of that, and all of those external factors are also preconditioned, well, those preconditioned things and entities are always in a constant state of flux. They're always changing. And if they're always changing, then plug those variables into your equation, or those values into the variables into your equation, and you get a result which is this thing called happiness, which is always changing. It's never the constant that is happiness that you want, that you're looking for in life. But in Buddhism, or in Buddhist philosophy, in Buddhist teaching, The fundamental teaching is that all things are conditioned, and the nature of all things that are conditioned is that when the conditions change, the result changes. So the cause and effect. When the causes change, the effect changes. And if you attach yourself, if you set expectations on something that is conditioned, well, when the causes change, the effect changes, and therefore you're going to be disappointed. So if you're looking for happiness by looking for the presence or the association of, say, a celestial being, it could be a god, it could be a Brahma, it could be an angel. If you think that is where happiness is going to be, well, then I would encourage you to consider and ponder what happens, or what if that god or that celestial being or that angel does not do the things that you want them to do? What happens then? What happens if they don't say the things that you like them to say? What happens if they don't agree with what you're doing, what you're saying, and so on? Then you're going to have a problem. Because you're looking for happiness through external factors. Whenever you're looking for happiness from external factors, from your external environment, that is a really risky thing to do. And it's never going to be permanent happiness, because all those external factors are constantly changing. And as I've just explained, when those things change, then the thing that you thought was bringing you happiness is going to change as well. A simple example would be, think about, you know, if you're a really young listener, think about the time when you got a new toy. when you got a new toy, and you remember when you were first given that toy, was brand stanking new, it did all these nice fancy things, all the lights came on, it made all these nice sounds, and it could move around just like you wanted it to, and all you had to do was just wind it up and watch it, and it would do all these fancy tricks, and it would make you really happy. But one day came when you found your dog had eaten or chewed off one of its wheels, or chewed off one of its legs or hands or arms or whatever that toy was. It could have been a doll, it could have been a toy car, and then what happened? Oh, perhaps you were playing with it and it fell from your hands and then it broke. Then what happened? Or perhaps the batteries ran out. Then what happened? Whatever the case might have been, or even if you just put it in your shelf and just keep looking at it, one day it's going to stop working. One day it's just not going to work again. Everything has an expiry date, and we talked about this in last week's sermon. Everything simply has an expiry date. And when that expiry date hits, if your happiness was dependent on that object, on that person, on that occurrence, on that incident, then you're going to be unhappy. You're going to be disappointed because you relied on that object, that person, that, that incident or that, that occurrence to make you happy. So what you should understand then is from the things that we've just been speaking about is we began with clarifying the fact that and coming to a common agreement that we're all looking for happiness in life. From the time, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you're looking for happiness. And then we began to consider where do people look for this happiness from. Some people look for it through science. And science, as we said, is about giving you new ways to live your life. It's about making life easier. And I've got nothing against science. I studied all the science as well. I was at school and college. And I would even say for the best part of my life, I was a scientist. And I've got nothing against science. In fact, you know, I use science to this day. How do you think I'm delivering this sermon? And how do you think you're able to listen to this sermon? It's because we have science. It's because we have technology, which is a product of science. I'm sat, you know, under lights and all of that are products of science and scientists. So, of course, we have to rely on science to do certain things. Buddhism is not going to help me solve that problem. I can't rely on Buddhism to help me preach this sermon to reach you wherever you are in the world. We need science for that. So use whatever you need for whatever that purpose is. With Buddhism, you can't cut a loaf of bread up. You can't slice up a loaf of bread with Buddhism. You need bread and butter for that. You need a knife for that. That only comes through science. Okay, so there's nothing against science. I don't have anything against science. The only thing I'm trying to say is, if what you're looking for in life is supreme bliss, ultimate happiness, that you're not going to get from science. Happiness, relief from discomfort, relief from pain, temporary relief and from pain and discomfort, yes, you're going to get from science. Medicine was a product of science. Buddhism is not going to help you cure your headache, or if you've got diarrhea, Buddhism is not going to help you with that. Christianity is not going to help you with that. Islam is not going to help you with that. Hinduism is not going to help you with that. Medicine is what's going to help you with that. And medicine was a product, is a product of science. So you need science for that. Okay? So I've got nothing against science. Let's just be clear. And then with all of the other religions, again, I've got no problem with any other religion. Any other teaching. In fact, you know, there are lots of varieties and versions of Buddhism that are being taught around the world. There's Zen Buddhism, there's Mahayana Buddhism, there's traditions, Theravada tradition. Then there are I think in the eastern part of the world there are lots of different types of, there's Taoism, which I think is related to Buddhism. I could be wrong, but there are lots of other teachings and philosophies and religions that give us a way to be happy. Okay, and remember again, the reason we're looking for happiness is because we are not happy right now. So we're looking for happiness in the future. So again, all of these teachings, all of these religions will give you, I presume, I haven't been a student of all of them, but the things that I have studied to some extent will give you a kind of happiness, but it's not going to be permanent happiness. It's not going to be supreme bliss. It's not going to be happiness that is everlasting, because they're all giving the happiness with all of those approaches is the result of external factors working in your favor. And what's wrong with things that are working in your favor? Well, one day it's not going to work in your favor because they're all conditioned. And when they're not working to your favor, then you're going to be disappointed. I'll use a really simple example. You know, obviously we have a huge population of people and listeners that believe in religions that talk about a supreme God, where some people, I mean, I used to have friends, I mean, I still do, who say, well, you know, things that happen to me is because God wants it to happen that way. What I would question them with them is, and in fact, you know, it's not a challenge, it's really just something I encourage them to think about is, well, if your happiness is dependent on this celestial being, supreme and omniscient God, then you're only going to be happy for as long as your God wants you to be happy. What happens when your God decides it's time for you to be sad? Well, you're going to be in terrible shape then. I mean, you know, just think about the tsunamis that hit Sri Lanka. You know, there'll be, absolutely there'll be people who died in that disaster. I mean, earthquakes happen all the time. There's volcanoes erupt, you know. When these natural disasters happen, for those people who say, you know, this is the result of, or this is what my God, this celestial being that I worship and that I revere, you know, this is what he wanted. Well, again, I'm not challenging that. All I'm saying is, well, if that is what you believe in, then your happiness, which is what you're looking for from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, from the moment you're born to the moment you die, is going to be dependent on what God wants for you. If he wants you to be happy, you're going to be happy. If he wants you to be sad, you're going to be sad. If he wants you to be disappointed, you're going to be disappointed. If he wants you to be frustrated, then you're going to be frustrated. Whereas Buddhist philosophy teaches a very different way to be happy. Because in Buddhism, we don't... The Lord Buddha, let me say, the Lord Buddha does not talk about finding happiness through external factors. He talks about happiness where there is no existence. If there is no existence, then you are not relying on external factors to make you happy. Because when you exist, then because of existence, you have to succumb to certain realities. For example, if you're alive, then you're going to be hungry. Think about, you know, just yourself. What do you do on a daily basis? The moment you wake up, you go put your kettle on. Why? Because you want a cup of tea to wake you up. Or that spurt of energy that you need from your morning coffee. Then you put some, you know, you get a breakfast because you are hungry. Then you get yourself a snack later on in the day because again you're feeling hungry. You want that spurt of energy again. Then lunchtime comes and again you have to feed yourself. Why? You're doing all of these things because you're existing, because you're alive. And then if you're not feeling well, you have to get yourself some medicine. If you need to get somewhere, then you have to use a medium of transport. If you're feeling thirsty, you need to get yourself a drink. So all of these things are the result of being alive. And this applies to humans, it applies to devas, it applies to brahmas. Remember, in one of the sermons we did recently, we talked about how the need to know and the need to sense is there for all beings. Everybody wants to, when I say everybody, I'm not only talking about human beings, I'm talking about devas, I'm talking about brahmas, I'm talking about anyone that's alive that is not a rahat, that is not an arahant, wants to know, wants to find out. And to achieve that, they will do things, they will say things, they'll go places, they'll do all sorts of things. And for as long as there's a need for that, this agitation exists. Mental and physical agitation exists. This vexation exists in the mind to try and achieve that state of fulfillment. To be able to find out what's going on, to be able to know what's going on, to be able to sense what's going on. Because that is the nature of the mind. The mind always wants to know. The mind always wants to find out. So even at that most basic level, from that most basic level to all the way down to having to feed oneself, having to go use the toilet, having to take a shower, having to get, you know, get medicines. All, you know, throughout that spectrum, you're trying to relieve yourself from discomfort so you can be happy. So what Buddhist philosophy teaches is, wherever you're having to do this, it's because you're alive. This is why we say, jati paccaya jara marna shoka parideva dukkha domana supayasa. The reason for all of this is because you're alive, because you're living, and with being alive comes jati, or with jati, which is being alive, being in existence, comes jara, which is decay, marana, which is death, vyadi, which is illness, shoka, which is being sorrowful. Parideva, which is lamentation, and so on. So all of these causes for suffering is a result of being alive in the first place. Now, when we come to accept this, and you don't have to accept this because I've told you so, you don't have to accept this because the Lord Buddha says so, not because it's in the scriptures, not because it's in the books, by all means, only accept this if this makes sense to you. This is why I say, keep looking until you find the truth. Apply this to your real life examples. This is what Yoniso Manasikara is all about. Apply this into your lives. Think about the times when, you know, as I said at the start, from the moment you are awake to the moment you go to sleep, isn't what you're doing looking for happiness. Think for yourselves. Look at your own lives. Introspect. Do you do anything else other than trying to find happiness? If not, then, well, that passes that test. Okay? And this is a hypothesis. Like you do any science experiment, you come up with a hypothesis and then you do these experiments to prove or disprove that hypothesis. Likewise, I'm giving you a hypothesis right now. Buddhist philosophy helps you find supreme bliss and happiness that is forever lasting. That's a hypothesis. You've got to go prove it for yourself. I can do my own experiments, but I can give you the results of my experiment, but you might believe me because you have faith in me, but that's not the same as conviction. That's the difference between faith, which is bhakti, and conviction, which is shraddha, which is what is really important in practice in the Buddhist path, the Buddhist teaching. You need conviction. Conviction is tried and tested. You apply the doctrine, you apply the philosophy, and you see, does it make sense to me? Does it apply to my life examples? Where does it not apply? Where does it not make sense? Then you go and clarify that again. You ask somebody, you speak to someone and say, hey, this does not apply, this does not work right here. Is it because there's something wrong with the philosophy, or is it because I understood it incorrectly? And then when you have a Kalyana Mitra, they'll help you understand that. They'll help you fill in those gaps. And then one day you're going to come to perfect understanding, yes, I now get it. All suffering was because I'm in existence. All suffering that I have to suffer, all kinds of sorrow, all kinds of grief, death and decay and old age and all of this is because I'm alive. It's because I'm in existence. So, wherever there's existence, whether that's in the human realm or the human world, whether it's in the Deva world, the Deva realm or in the Brahma realms, wherever that is, you know, we don't even need to talk about the hells, okay? So, because we all know that's just complete suffering. So, you're listening to this because you're not in the hells. So let's talk about what is real to you, what you can relate to right now. Wherever you are, the reason you're suffering is because you're in existence. It is because you're in existence you have to satisfy your needs and your wants and your requirements. Your desire to know something, your desire to want something. Remember we talked in the past about a time when, you know, say it's your birthday and your friend comes walking through the door, he's got this gift wrapped in a wrapping paper. How are you feeling right now? You're feeling really agitated. You're feeling, you want to know what is that toy that's just been brought, what's that gift that has just been brought to you? You can't rest until your visitors leave and you get the chance to unwrap those gifts and find out for yourself what they are. How does that make you feel? That makes you agitated. You want to know. You want to find out. Even that is a kind of suffering. When it comes to Buddhist philosophy, that is a kind of suffering. Because you're restless at that time. You just want to know. When you walk past the TV and someone else is watching TV, you know, even without you knowing, your eyes turn towards the TV because you want to know what's on TV. If you hear someone else speaking a language that you understand, well, guess what happens to your mind? Guess what happens to you? Without you even knowing it, your attention is now focused on them. You try and read a book where you're standing in the proximity of two people talking with each other in a language that you understand. It's going to be incredibly difficult to do it. Why? Because your mind is always running on, your mind wants to know, what are they talking about? Is it something that you can understand? Again, you know, I've given you examples of when I used to travel on the tube and how people consider that talking on the phone while you're on the tube or on a train or in some kind of public transport, particularly in the UK, you know, it's impolite, it's rude. Well, why do people say that? It's because you can't hear the other person speaking. So you can only hear the person that is standing in front of you having a one-sided conversation. Well, obviously they're having a dialogue with somebody else, but you can't hear what the other person is saying. So you're hearing one part of the conversation. He goes, no, what? She said that? And well, what do you think your mind's doing right now? Your mind wants to know, what is it that she said? You saw your mind in a state of agitation and in a state of frustration. It wants to know. So because it wants to know, you've been put into that situation. You think because that man's on the phone talking to this other guy, and he shouldn't be doing that because he's now making you uncomfortable. So you think that the problem is with him making you uncomfortable. The reason he's on the phone is why you think you're unhappy. Again, this is what we're saying. Your happiness apparently is dependent on all these external factors. So everyone that should stop talking on the phone when they're with you. They should not be reading books. Well, what happens when they're reading books? Everyone wants to know what kind of book are they reading. Imagine someone's got a book and it's got some kind of cover and you can't see through the cover. Well, immediately you want to know what is the book they're reading. This is in real life examples. Someone has a newspaper in their hands and you want to know what's in that newspaper. You hear a sound that you hear from behind you. Guess what everyone does? They'll just turn around and see what's that sound, where is it coming from. You just want to know, and sometimes it's got nothing to do with you. Why do people watch news? Why do people go watch the television? And when you're living and you need to know what's happening in your neighborhood. Again, as I say, I've got nothing against that, right? If there's been a robbery in your neighborhood, perhaps you have to watch out. You have to be careful. Yes, of course, all of that is right. But if you're living in the UK, why do you need to know what's happening in the States? Why do you need to know what's happening in Australia? Why do you need to know what's happening in the other part of the world when you don't know the first, you don't even know the names of some of those people? You're never going to go there. You're never going to have anything to do with them, but you still want to know. This is why most people turn on the televisions and watch TV and read newspapers and so on and so forth. So, again, some examples for you to try and relate to and look for yourself and think for yourself. Okay, so all of this is because your mind is constantly looking to sense, it's looking to recognize, it's looking to identify this feeling of this state of looking for Vedana and Sanya. Okay, as long as that exists, your mind is in a state of agitation. And that is true for all beings that are alive. So even from that, at that most basic level of wanting to know and wanting to find out, to the levels of where on the other end of the spectrum you're suffering in the hells, really. I mean, that is the worst that it can be. From that one extreme to the other, every being is suffering. I mean, even think of an arahant. An arahant has to go on alms for food. Why? Because he's still in existence. He's still alive. When an arahant is feeling sick, when he's feeling ill, he needs to, this is what did the doctor Jivaka do in the Buddha's time? He used to come and attend to the Lord Buddha. He used to come and attend to his disciples and treat them on a regular basis. And the reason he did that is because, well, even if you're an arahant, you still got a body that is subject to death and subject to illness and subject to decay. So they have to be treated. And so you need a doctor. Again, all this is because you're alive. So wherever there is cause for you to be alive, wherever there's cause for you to be born again, to be in existence, then you're subject to decay, you're subject to death, you're subject to sorrow and grief and disappointment, and particularly where you're expecting that happiness to come from external factors, you're always going to be disappointed. Well, you're going to be happy for as long as those conditions work out in your favor. But again, think back to real life examples in your life and think, would they always work in your favor? Think about your siblings, think about your parents, think about your job, think about your husband, your wife, think about your car, think about when you went on holiday, think about the last time you went to your favorite restaurant. Okay, was it always, think about your neighbors, think about your toys, think about your computer, think about your favorite video game. Literally anything and everything that is conditioned, did it always work in your favor? Did it always work to your liking? Was there never a time when you felt frustrated, disappointed, agitated? Think and reflect, because that is the only way you're going to understand this. Otherwise, I could be sat here giving you example after example, metaphor after metaphor, analogy after analogy. It's not going to make any difference if you're not going to think and apply it to your own lives. And analyze it for yourself and test this hypothesis until it becomes crystal clear, until it becomes clear without a shadow of a doubt, yes, that is absolutely the truth. All my life I've been looking for happiness, but that happiness I've been expecting from external factors, and all those external factors were preconditioned. When the conditions were right, they fulfilled what I was looking for, they fulfilled and they gave me happiness. But when those conditions changed, then I still remained attached and associated them, and then as a result of that I was disappointed and I was frustrated. So you're always in a constant state of flux, from happiness to sadness, to sorrow, to satisfaction, to unsatisfaction, to fulfillment, to unfulfillment. So you're always going up and down, up and down, up and down, like the waves of the ocean. Whereas the Lord Buddha comes into the world, this world, and says, "Hey, why do you subject yourself to that kind of going the ups and downs of life? This is life in itself. You know, if you rely on external factors, then this is the curse that you bring on yourself. When I can teach you the way to stop relying on external factors to make yourself happy, and there in itself you're going to be happy." Because for as long as you are looking for those external factors to make you happy, you're going to have to expect to be disappointed. But when you understand that external factors cannot bring you the happiness that you think that you're going to get from them, because your definition of happiness is in fact flawed as well, when you do that, once you do that, then you're going to dissociate yourself, you're going to detach yourself, you're no longer going to set expectations on those external factors to make you happy, then you're really going to find happiness. This is why in previous sermons as well, we discussed on what is this happiness, what is this satisfaction, what is this fulfillment that we look for. And in the past we have talked about this quite a bit, but it's probably worth revisiting this topic a little bit. You know, think about when you're feeling hungry, and you find yourself some food that makes you happy immediately. But the reason that makes you happy, and you think, well, so think about what happens in your mind at that moment in time. You're feeling really hungry, food arrives on a plate and it's in front of you, and what are your thoughts right now? That food is going to make me happy. An external factor is going to make me happy. My happiness is dependent on that external factor. So what do you do now? You start eating that food. This is what you got to analyze then. Do you feel the same level of happiness when you first start eating it by the time you finish eating that food? No, of course not. Why? Because when you started eating it, you felt particularly hungry. You know, hunger was if you put it on a scale. Imagine there's a scale of hunger from 0 to 10, where 10 being I'm very hungry, to 0 being I'm completely full. Do not show me or even talk to me about food right now, because otherwise I'm going to throw up. I'm stuffed. Okay, that's your 0. You start at a 10, where you're really hungry. Think of the time when you've gone to a buffet. You'll know from experience, sometimes people go to buffets and they don't eat the 3 meals before that, because they starve themselves. It's crazy how people subject themselves to torment and so much pain and discomfort, to then go and find a way to relieve themselves from that pain and therefore find this thing that they call this happiness. How essenceless is that? How meaningless is that? Is that whole process? You know, really think about that time when you last went to a buffet, particularly if you're adults. Then you'll be able to relate to this experience, because young people, their minds are not as polluted and it's not as distorted to kind of work out in this way. Particularly adults, what they do is, before you go to a buffet restaurant and to go to a buffet, you starve like 3 or 4 meals before that. I know people who've done this. Even yesterday I went to a sermon and I was really giving this example, and people started laughing because, you know, this is their experience. Okay? So you starve. You starve because then you know when you go to the restaurant, you are feeling really hungry. And you're on a scale of 0 to 10, you are at 12 right now, okay? And so you start stuffing yourself with food. You start stuffing yourself with food. You fill your plate up, like food's running out, like there's food's going out of fashion. You stuff your plate with all kinds of food that you can grab hold of, and you come back and return to your plate, you return to your table, and now, you know, if you could, thank God you've only got two arms. If you had four of those arms, you'd be stuffing yourself through all holes that you can imagine, through your nose and through your mouth and through your ears. Because that's how hungry you're feeling right now, and you're thinking that food is going to make me happy. And so you start stuffing yourself. But when you come to the middle of that plate, as in you've consumed about half the food that's on that plate, then you stop to talk to the guy next to you. And you start to comment on the food as you come to the end of the first serving. Why? Where were those comments when you first started eating? No comments. Everyone's silent at that time because, well, you're feeling really happy right now. You're feeling this sense of fulfillment because you're feeling really hungry. And as this food is going in, the first few bites, the first few mouthfuls, your hunger is starting to be quenched, and therefore you're thinking that food is what's making you happy. Whereas in fact, what's really making you happy is relieving yourself from hunger. That is what's making you happy. Relieving yourself from a feeling of discomfort, from a feeling of unsatisfaction, from a feeling of unfulfillment. It's relieving yourself from a state of agitation. That is what is making you happy at that moment in time. But not realizing that, you think that it's the food that's making me happy. So you keep stuffing yourself with that food. And then towards the second serving, towards the middle of the third serving, now the reason you're eating is because you paid for that buffet. Because you paid to eat as much as you can. That's why you're eating right now. Not because you want that food. One plateful is all you can stomach. Next time you go to a buffet, think about this. I'm not saying don't go to buffets. No, that's the last thing I'd say. Go to a buffet. In fact, go, if you're listening to this, you know, next time you have an opportunity to go out, all of you in the family, go to a buffet. Serve yourselves some food. Come back to the table and between yourselves, obviously as an experiment, right? If you are going out with your partner or perhaps with your family, in your mind you know what's going on right now because you've listened to this sermon. Don't give this out to the other people if they haven't listened to this as yet, and watch them, see how they work, because you might struggle to observe it in yourself because now you know what you know this, but so someone who doesn't know, observe them, see how they operate. The first serving, they come back and they won't even stop to talk. The first few mouths go in straight after they are sat down. Why? Because they are so hungry. And they're thinking, and you know, ask them, how is that food? When they've had their first bite, how is that food? Oh, it's really nice, it's really good. But a few mouthfuls later, well actually it's a bit too salty, I thought. Or it's a bit too sour. It's got a little bit too much sweet here. Now they're starting to comment on that food because those criticisms they didn't think of when they first started eating. Why? Because they, you know, all they could see is, oh, this food is so satisfying. This food is ambrosia. Okay? But as you continue to satisfy and relieve yourself from your hunger, that hunger goes from a 10 to an 8 to a 7 to a 6, and it's slowly and gradually working its way back to a 0. And as it goes past a 5 or a 4, now it's time to stop. You're finding it hard to breathe. You unbuckle your belt and, you know, move it down a few notches. Okay? And you have to make room now in your stomach. And sometimes, you woke up, you go for a bit of a walk and you come back and sit down again. All these things I've seen people do, you know, right in front of my eyes. Okay? And this is why I want you to reflect on these experiences. Think about if you do these things. I'm not saying don't do any of these things. I'm saying when you do it, do this consciously. Think about what we've just talked about today. Think about what you've learned today and apply that. And then this is what's going to help you understand yourself. Remember when we said at the start, Buddhism is about understanding yourself more than understanding anything else. Because once you've understood yourself, you've understood the world. That is what understanding the world is all about. When an arahant is born, an arahant has understood the world. And in understanding the world, an arahant has understood himself. It's nothing else other than that. Yes, he'll know about the suns and stars and other celestial planets and all of those things. He may or may not know, but he will know himself. He will have completely eradicated all kinds of ignorance and delusion about himself. He'll know how his mind operates. He'll know why his mind used to operate in a certain way, and he'll know that he has eradicated desire, aversion and delusion, and how he's completely free of all those defilements now. That is all there is to understanding oneself. Okay? So when you go to that restaurant, this is an experiment I want you to do. And then once you've done that, talk to the other people on the table and then explain to them, hey, you know guys, this is something I learned when I listened to that sermon the other day. How did you feel when you first started eating? How are you feeling right now? You know, when you're all finished with your plate and you're waiting for the bill to turn up, okay, when you're waiting for that check, now have that conversation. Or perhaps on your way back from the restaurant, how are you guys feeling right now? You know, some of them will have already fallen asleep because they're completely stuffed and they can't talk and walk or do anything else. But there'll be others who you'll still be able to have a conversation with. And tell them, you know, how did you feel when you first walked into that restaurant? When you saw that food laid out in those aisles, and before you even started eating, did you not think that food looks delicious? Why did your mouth start watering when you looked at that food? In fact, if your mouth is watering right now as I'm talking about this, why is it doing it right now? Because when I'm talking about a buffet restaurant, I'm talking about food, what's happening in your mind is your mind's going back to all those Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana that's stored in your memory banks. And it's bringing them back out and it's thinking about those times when those experiences made you happy. But those experiences made you happy. Why? Because you were in a state of discomfort, in a state of pain, and you were looking for relief. But the problem is, if you come to the conclusion that it's the food that made me happy, it's the drink that made me happy, it's all these external factors that made me happy, that's where you're going wrong. This is what science tells you. This is why science throws out a new gadget every day. This is why science gives you a new way to cook food every day. This is why science gives you a new kind of soft drink every day. Why? Because it teaches you, well, here's a better way to relieve yourself from discomfort. And every day and all day long, you're trying to quench your hunger, you're trying to put out those fires that ignite within your mind, not within your body, within your mind, by relying on these products that come out from science. That's where people go wrong. This is why the Lord Buddha says, no, happiness is simply relieving yourself from discomfort. Happiness is simply relieving yourself from pain. Comfort is simply relieving yourself from discomfort. Satisfaction is simply relieving yourself from unsatisfactoriness. Fulfillment is simply relieving yourself from unfulfillment until you come across Nibbana. Because Nibbana is where you have ceased, you have stopped all the reasons that put you in a place, in a position where you are cursed with this problem of having to put out those fires. If you don't have to put out those fires, then you don't have that problem. Let me give you this analogy. If the reason you go to the dentist, and once the dentist has treated you, perhaps, you know, say you've got an aching tooth, and the dentist pulls out that tooth, now you're feeling relieved, you're feeling a sense of, that pain is gone, and now you're feeling okay, you're feeling better. You're feeling that now because that tooth has been pulled out. But you didn't feel this satisfaction, this relief, before that tooth went bad. When that tooth was okay, when it was healthy, when it was a healthy tooth, you didn't feel the same sense of happiness and relief. The reason you're feeling this relief right now is because it was a tooth that went bad, it was painful, it was hurting, and then that got pulled out, and now you're feeling happiness. Well, what if you didn't have a mouthful of teeth in the first place? I mean, forget for a fact that for a moment that, you know, that you wouldn't be able to live a life without teeth. But if you could, right? If you could and you didn't have teeth in the first place, then you wouldn't have to go to the dentist in the first place. You wouldn't have to suffer from decayed teeth in the first place. Or another example would be, well, when you have a house, it could, you know, there could be a house fire, and now you've got to put out the fire. When you put out the fire, you feel a sense of relief. Yes, I've put out the fire now. I'm feeling better than I used to be. But what if you didn't have the house in the first place? There wouldn't be a fire to begin with. There wouldn't be causes for a fire to begin in the first place. So likewise, the Nibbana is all about finding those causes which can over time and invariably will over time give you cause for suffering, and eradicating those causes at the root so that those causes do not exist for you to give rise to pain and discomfort and unsatisfaction and fulfillment in future. That is what Nibbana is. And that is the Lord Buddha's teaching. So if you're looking for happiness then, and this is what, as we said at the beginning, we're all looking for in life. If you're looking for happiness, and you're looking for happiness externally, well, what you've got to reflect on is the fact that all of those external factors are conditioned, preconditioned. When those conditions change, the result's going to change, the effect's going to change. Cause and effect. This is the Lord Buddha's teaching, cause and effect. And when the effect changes, when the result changes, if you're still attached to what was there when the previous set of causes were in action, well, guess what's going to happen now? You're going to be disappointed. You're going to be frustrated. Again, I gave you the example of the toy. I'll give you another example. Think of the time when a guy meets a young girl, he gets married, brings her home, okay? He looks at the girl, he's attached to that wife of his, and he thinks, well, you know, she's really good looking, she's really nice to me, she speaks in lovely words, she's got a soft voice and all this, that and the other. But over time, all of that changes. Over time, she's going to grow old. She's going to have gray hair on her head. She's not going to be able to walk and talk like she used to. She's going to fall ill. And then now, who's going to now? Because you've set all those expectations, and at the beginning you thought, well, you know, this is you were attached to not the girl that fell ill. You weren't attached to the old age grandmother that she is now. You were attached to the young, pretty girl that was there 50, 40, 60 years ago. But that is not the result you have today. So you were attached to what was there previously, and that changed because the causes changed, the conditions changed, and as a result, the result changed, and now, well, you can't let go. You're bound by societal arrangements and societal formalities that, you know, you've got to live with her now. So this is the reality, and obviously women, you've got to think of it, you know, the other way around, vice versa. So this is what we need to reflect on, and the same applies to everything. Whether you're bound by societal norms and formalities or not, you know, think about the, you know, if you bought yourself a car, you go to the showroom, and now you're looking at the car, your dream car. It's got a new paint. It's got all the gadgets. The electrics work fine. You can turn the wheel with just your finger. But over time, you know, it's gonna decay. It's gonna grow old. It's gonna by growing old. I mean, it's gonna come to the end of its lifespan, and then it's gonna have to be discarded, and you're gonna have to go and get a new one. And then you've got to take it to the garage. You've got to get it serviced. All of these things are not things you're attached to. But you have to do it. Why? To maintain those conditions that were there that gave you the result that you were attached to in the first place. So this is the dukkha dukkha, the viparinama dukkha, and the sankara dukkha that you have to always subject and you have to subject yourself to when you go and attach yourself to that object, that external factor which thought was going to bring you happiness. So where if you're looking for happiness from external factors, then you're always going to continue to suffer. Why? Because you're always going to suffer from dukkha dukkha, which is, what's going to happen to this? Would it break? Would it fall? Would someone come and take it away from me? Right? You're always in a state of agitation and frustration and vexation. Okay? And then there's viparinama dukkha. Well, no matter how much you're going to protect it, one day it's going to stop. One day it's going to break. It's like that grandfather's clock that stopped ticking one fine day. Okay, so that day is going to come, and when that day comes, you're going to suffer. You're going to be sorrowful, and then abhisankara dukkha, the dukkha that you have to endure because you have to continue to feed the causes that give you the result that you were attached to in the first place. All of this you have to do because you attach yourself to that object or that person or that occurrence. Because before you went and attached yourself, you didn't have to worry about any of those things. It was someone else's problem. But the moment you attached yourself, now it's your problem. So what you really did is to relieve yourself from discomfort, from pain, from unsatisfaction. You took away someone else's problem and made it your problem. Now you've got all of the above plus all of these new problems as well. So have you not just jumped from the pan to the fire? That's what you've just done. Again, you know, don't just take this because I'm saying so. Don't just take this because it says so in the Tripitaka. Apply this into your lives. Think about all the times when you went and attached yourself to something. Was this not what happened to you? And is this not why you can't rely on external things to bring you happiness? Because all the time, all it's going to bring you is dukkha dukkha, viparinama dukkha and sankhara dukkha. Of course, you know, you turn on a fan when you're feeling hot, it's going to blow some wind at you and you're going to feel better. Of course you are. You're going to feel cool. I'm not arguing that. There's no debate about that. But if you come to the conclusion that, oh well, that's okay then. Whenever I'm feeling hot, all I've got to do is turn my fan on. So that's fine. I can just continue to live every day and, you know, throughout sansara, whenever I'm going to feel hot, I'll just switch on the fan and I'm going to be okay. Well, you're not going to have a fan every day. And the fan that you bought, you're going to have to maintain, you're going to have to get it serviced, you're going to have to pay for it, you're going to have to pay the electricity bill. Okay? And money don't grow on trees, so you have to go and work for it. Okay? So you have to do all of these things to get you that satisfaction, to feel that relief. But not only that, you have the opportunity to stop birth in the first place. So you don't feel hot. So when you have the path to relieve yourself at the root, to cut it off at the bottom, at the root, and not have to suffer in the first place, well, why do you go treat the problem when you can remove the problem in the first place? It's like there's a patient that's got some kind of disease, and that disease, it diminishes when they take some medicine, you know. So say he's got some kind of pain, and that pain reduces when he takes some medicine. So what if this patient goes around saying, well, that's okay, then as long as I can take this medicine, it reduces the pain, then that's fine, I'll live with this pain. Another doctor comes along and says, well, what are you doing? You're crazy. I can give you another medicine that will cure your problem once and for all. When you have that option, if you go, no, that's okay, I'm happy with this disease, I'll just take my medicine and that's going to reduce my pain, and I'll just continue doing that, aren't you mad? When you have the option, and I'm telling you, when you have the option to cure yourself once and for all, isn't that what you should be focusing on for the most part of your time? I mean, when we don't have the Buddha, when we don't have his Dhamma, when we don't have the Mahasangha, then okay, you know, do all these other things. But when you have the path to liberation, when you have the way to put a stop once and for all to this problem that is rebirth, which gives you all, which brings with it this package of frustration, of sorrow, of pain and agony and the suffering that comes with the loss of your loved ones, and when your faculties stop working, your body doesn't work like it used to, when you have to crawl and not walk because your body can't support yourself, when you can't see, when you can't hear, when you can't feel, when you can't sense, when your brain stops working, all of this you have to suffer. When you're hungry, when you're not feeling well, when you're feeling cold, and when you're feeling hot, when you're bitten by ants and insects and all types of things, when you're in the middle of a war, when there's people trying to come and attack you and steal your money, and all of these calamities of life, when all of these vicissitudes of life you have to suffer because you're alive in the first place, and someone comes and says, hey mister, I can give you the way to redeem yourself once and for all, where you're not going to be born and therefore you're not going to have to subject to all of these things. If you chose to say, no, that's okay, I'll just continue living and treat my problems as and when they come, isn't there something that's fundamentally wrong with you? This is what you got to think. This is what you've got to think about really on a day-to-day basis. So, I hope it gives you something to think about, because remember where we started this conversation from. We do all of these things to be happy. In trying to be happy, what we find ourselves doing is actually bringing on ourselves even more sources of pain and suffering and hardship and discomfort. Well, if that is what we keep doing, then we are not fulfilling our objective. We are not fulfilling what we set off to do. If you wanted to find yourself some water because you're thirsty, and what you're finding is your every step you take, you're walking towards a desert, well, you're mistaken. You're going to die. This is what people do. They're really thirsty. There's a well just 100 yards in the opposite direction. But someone comes along and say, an immoral person, Asat Purusha Sevan, an ignoble and immoral person comes to you and says, hey, there's this beautiful desert where you're going to find lots of water. You know, the Seri Vanija Jataka is just that. If you have not had an opportunity, you know, pick up the Jataka Pota, where these are the stories of the Bodhisattva in his. There are about 540 odd stories there, when he was a Bodhisattva. Read them, and there is one particular story called the Seri Vanija Jataka. Sorry, not the Seri Vanija Jataka. This is the I can't remember the name of the Jataka now, but it's the story where he's a merchant and he goes with his carts full of merchandise. He and Devadatta, when he was also a merchant and in that time, they go from land to land. They are traveling merchants, and they go across this desert, and what they both were unable to do is take enough water with them. But the Bodhisattva on that occasion uses his wisdom to, when he comes across this these demons where they meet on the desert, and these demons say, hey, you know, they come with wet hair and water lilies and things like that, because this is the they're coming to kill these people and to take their meat to destroy them and feast on the cows, on the bullocks that are pulling these carts. That's what the demons are coming for. But they come pretending like their hair is wet and they've got water lilies and flowers all over their bodies and mud in their on their feet. And when they meet the first set of merchants, where that is the Devadatta in his previous birth, he falls for this trap. He advises his fellow travelers to throw away all the water that they were carrying with them, and because it's going to be an easier journey, and that apparently that there's going to be an oasis nearby. And then they travel and travel and travel, and ultimately what they find is they run out of water. They don't have any water, and they don't come across any water. And overnight, when they're really thirsty and they're really famished, these demons, they come and they come and destroy the entire they kill the people and the bullocks and they feast on them. Whereas the Bodhisattva, he comes later on and he uses his wisdom and decides, no, it can't be the case that in the middle of a desert I'm going to be able to find any water, like these people say, or like these demons say. And he thinks, actually, these can't be real people. They must be demons. They're pretending to be kind to us, but this is only going to cause us immense suffering. So he advises his fellow travelers, you will not be throwing away any water without asking me, and you will not be eating anything that you don't know. We will not be stopping anywhere. We shall continue to travel. And so there's that story, and how he saves his entourage by using his wisdom. So go read this story as well. But at the same time, the reason that I thought about this story is because, you know, in search for water, when someone's really thirsty, if you're walking towards the desert and there's a well a few hundred yards in the opposite direction, well, aren't you mistaken? So This is why you need the association of noble people. Because a noble person comes to you and says, the problem that you have is that you are alive, you are in existence. Being born is the root cause for these problems. What you do in life, in your search for happiness, in your pursuit for happiness, is always and constantly bring more problems in your direction. You are walking towards a fire. Your head's on fire and you're walking towards another fire. And they say, that's not what you should be doing. Put out that fire. And I can give you the way to do it. I can teach you how to do it. But, so without doing that, if you continue to go on that path, then clearly you're not going to find yourself the happiness that you set out to achieve in your life in the first place. So this is essentially the fundamental teaching of Buddhism at its most basic. I hope you've been able to learn from what we've just discussed today that the reason that we have the Buddha's teaching is not to achieve anything that is supernatural, supernormal. You know, there's nothing like that. It is an answer to the problem that we are all suffering from. It's an answer to the problem that we've always been looking for an answer, and that is, how do I be happy? So the Buddha's teaching is nothing else. It's no different in what its objective is, in what its aim is, from any other religion. It's not different in what its aim is from what science helps us do today, to help you be happy, which is what we all agreed at the start is what we are all looking for in life. But where the Buddha's teaching differs fundamentally and 180 degrees from all other teachings is where the Lord Buddha's teaching is, it's the things that you attach to that bring you unhappiness. Whereas other philosophies say, no, the more you go and attach yourself to things, pick and choose the things you want to attach to, but regardless, where you attach yourself to something, then that brings you happiness. Whereas the Buddha's teaching is, whatever you attach yourself to, you're going to set expectations on. And the moment you set expectations on conditioned things, preconditioned things, when those conditions change, you're going to suffer. And he also says, these things that you believe are sources of happiness, sources of satisfaction, are not really sources of happiness or satisfaction. The reason you feel happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment is because you're suffering before that. You're suffering, and to relieve yourself from that pain and discomfort, you go after these things. And then you fall into this wrong and delusional view that it's those external things that brought you that happiness in the first place. So walk away from that. That's not what you should be doing. What you should be doing is finding the root cause for that problem, which is existence, jati, and it's bhava that brings you jati. So this is why Patijsamuppada or dependent origination is particularly required. And this is by which I don't mean you have to take a book on Patijsamuppada and read it and then you will be fine. What I mean is you have to understand this is where the problem is. This is where the problem is, and this is the path to cessation of that problem. And then therefore, through that, by practicing that path, you lead yourself to liberation. The Buddha can only teach us how to do that. We have to walk that path. He can't come and take us by the hand and take us to the water. We've got to walk to the water and we've got to drink it. But without leaving any room for doubt, without leaving any room for suspicion, without leaving any room for debating or argument, he has given us, in his perfect wisdom, in his perfect and infinite compassion, he's given us the path, and it's there in black and white, it's there crystal clearly, and that path to liberation, that path to becoming an arahant, is available today, it prevails today. But what we should all be doing is practicing that path, and once you come across that teaching, give it time, because when you want to plant a tree, you plant the seed, you put some water, you put some fertilizer, you let some sunlight, you come back the following day and you see, hey, there's no plant, you don't say, hey, this plant's never going to grow. You got to give it time. But what if, you come back the second day, there's no plant, what do you do is you go and you dig the soil up again and you plant a second seed. Then you come back the next day, oh, that doesn't work either. There's no plant. Then you put another seed in there. You dig the soil up and you put another seed in there. Well, every time you keep doing that, you don't give those seeds time to germinate. And therefore, you're never going to get a plant out of that. If you're giving it the right causes, if you're creating the right conditions, then the result is going to be there. You're going to get to those noble attainments. But you've got to give it time. Once you realize this path will help me get myself to liberation, I can see how detaching myself from things or allowing myself to be detached from things when I listen to the Dhamma is what's going to make me happy, then practice that path. Practice it for a little time. Listen to these sermons. Invest some time in this. Like you do with any other investment. You don't put some money in the bank today, go tomorrow and go, where's my interest? And they say, well, it's just a couple of pennies. You don't say, oh, well, that's pointless then. Let me draw my money out and go, and you put in your money in another bank. No, you've got to give it time. You've got to give it time to compound. You've got to give it a couple of years. That's when you're going to grow compounded interest. Likewise, you know, anything is the same. Give it time. But before that, make sure you're looking for the right answer. And to do that, make sure you're trying to answer the right problem. If happiness is what you're looking for, make sure that whatever path you walk, whatever solution you seek, gives you happiness. And that is something that you can check and look for before you start walking the path. This is why the Buddha teaches us, walking the path of liberation is something that you do after having seen the result. It's not a case of you get to the result and then go, oh right, okay, that's interesting. That's not how you walk the path of Nibbana. You see Nibbana and then you walk towards it. And it's the reason we do these sermons is to help you all see Nibbana. To see enlightenment, to realize, to understand that this is the path that's going to help you get there. And that is what becoming a Sotapanna is all about. It's realizing that detachment is what's going to bring me happiness, because it's attachment that got me so suffering all the time. So cessation of that attachment is what brings me happiness, and the path to that cessation can only be the path that can help me redeem myself. So practice this. Listen to this sermon again if that helped you, and also particularly for those listeners who might be new to this philosophy or to this way of thinking, or perhaps if you've been listening to some more profound teachings or some more deep teachings lately, then I would encourage you to listen to this a few times, and then hopefully some of those questions that you have will be answered. If you have any questions even after this, then by all means please drop us a question on Skype or on YouTube, and then we can pick it up from there. Let us transfer the merits that we have all acquired to all those beings that we invited before the start of our sermon. So, in having discussed the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, in having preached the Lord Buddha's Dhamma for about over 2 hours now, we have gathered a lot of merits, and let us transfer those merits to all the devas, the brahmas and spirits and demons and all those celestial beings that we invited at the start of this sermon. Also the dead and anyone that would be in our relations in the past, throughout our journey in samsara, anyone that might have helped us get to where we are today. Be that in offering us a glass of water or perhaps just pointing us in the right direction where they saw us walking down the wrong path. Whatever it is and whoever it is that might have helped us achieve any kind of happiness, any kind of satisfaction, any kind of liberation up until the point today, up until this point, may they all be able to rejoice in these merits. May they all be able to receive the transference of these merits. May they all be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. And anyone that helped us make this meritorious event a success, including all those scientists that invent technology or the things that we use in thanks to technologies, these computers, these microphones, the internet and so on and so forth, including anyone that helps us by making these facilities available to us, this accommodation available to us. May all those beings be able to rejoice in these merits, and also anyone who they are related to, if any one of them are born in the woeful planes, may they be able to rejoice in these merits and be born in the blissful plane. May these merits help all of them be born in blissful planes, and ultimately attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May all of us who have participated in today's sermon, in preaching the sermon or in listening to the sermon, and having made a firm determination at the beginning to help this, to help us, to and a hope and determination that this sermon helps us attain the noble achieve the noble attainments of Sotapanna, Sakurdagami, Anagami, and Arahat. May those wishes be fulfilled, and may all of us attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana in the era of Gautama Samma Sambuddha itself. May all beings attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Devan Sarnam.